If you look at my characters, you'll find me. No matter what kind of character you create or assume, a little of yourself must remain there.
Hi, and welcome to episode 112 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where small press comics make a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars, and joining me for this week's crackling episode of Comic Delights are creator of the superhero webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
The ghost who walks the walk and talks the talk, Mr. Tony Esmond.
We're all a bit on tenterhooks, aren't we? Because it's a big weekend coming up. We just spent the last 5 minutes telling each other that we're just going to constantly wind each other up.
Yeah.
At London Super Comic Con.
Yeah.
So Vince is staying at my house. That's going to be a fucking mess to start with.
As we said, Tony's City's still that early.
Yeah.
It's already begun.
Yeah.
if this is low level, going to build up into some kind of crescendo.
It's going to end up with us stripped to the waist like wrestling behind the table. And
If there was a soundtrack for this coming weekend, you know the Joker's theme in The Dark Knight, which is just like a growing uneasy noise that just... yeah. But it's going to be a good time, though. Can't wait.
What about the new trailer for the It soundtrack? That has a great soundtrack. It should be that.
That would totally work.
That would work.
Is that the same film as Baby Boss? That's good, isn't it?
Kind of. Yeah. It's like Baby Boss, but for kids.
Oh, good.
Same themes and story beats.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
Everything always comes back to Baby Boss.
Yeah. I've never watched that film and I never will, but there you go.
Yeah, you will.
I watched it last weekend.
Should we cosplay like it?
Right. We had one that we... I do cosplay like it. No, I don't. At the end of this show, we're going to have Dan Butcher's one-sentence review of Baby Boss.
Oh, yes.
But before we get to that, you probably heard him giggling just then, and he interrupted us while we were doing our intros, so we might as well introduce him. We're also joined by a hugely talented artist and all-round diamond geezer of the highest order. It's Matt Harrower. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey.
You are, Matt.
From our previous Triumph of Shit Comics episode...
We're going to genius.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. We've had the lows, and this week is going to be the highs. So there you go. But I tell you a place where you can't find shit comics, and that's comichouse.com. Nothing but net. Yes, as always, this show is brought to you with the help of our good friends at comichouse.com. They were basically set up as a marketplace and database site where creators can buy and sell their comic books, but oh lordy lord, they've become much more. They've got an app, they've got an anthology that the lovely Dan Butcher and myself have actually contributed to, and also there's just more exciting things coming along. There's so many indie titles on there. And a few bigger name ones as well, if that's your bag. So it's well worth checking out, especially if you want to support indie creators you might not be able to see at conventions. Because there's so many conventions so many conventions that we can't make it to. There was one just kind of in my neck of the woods today that I couldn't make it to.
It was out in Emmerdale Country, wasn't it? It was. Is that Emmerdale Country? I don't know.
No, it's not Emmerdale.
Oh, okay. It was True Believers today, wasn't it? Everyone looked like they had a brilliant time.
Yes, that was lovely. But unfortunately, I couldn't make it. So it was great that everyone else had.
Wouldn't have been that good then.
Well, you know, I'm a party monster. much like most of the creators who are on Comic House. So there you go.
Oh, fuck hell.
Now, their app that they're currently creating at the moment is going to be like Netflix for comics, and it's awesome. For a small subscription fee that is essentially the price of just one big two book each week, you'll have a monthly supply of comics. Their library is open to you. And there's so many great creators like submitting to it. Dan Butcher's submitted to it. Oh, I've got to get off my lazy bum and sort it out. And there's creators are starting to upload to the app now, so it's so they're quite excited about that.
When's it looking to go live? Do you know?
Fairly soon. I don't want to say anything too concrete just yet. I'll get the concrete details of that and then we'll announce it properly. Okay. So they've already tested it with a few creators, and it all seems well. So
nice.
Oh, brilliant.
So they wanted us to know that. And also, they also need creators to continue to claim their creator and publisher profiles as well.
Yeah.
Which is basically, what is it, Dan? It's like the info about you and et cetera, stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever taken part in Comic House, your creator profile will be on the site, and you can just say, claim this email, you follow the link and okay it. And you can essentially edit the photo they've got of you if you want one, and the various creator info and social media links.
Oh, Slice does the same, actually. Slice has got a similar thing.
So then it's easier for people to search certain creators and stuff, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
So if you kind of like, you'd look at Vince and say, oh, I really like Vince's work on Comic House.
Oh, thanks.
Click Lintz, and then it would jump. It would show you the other stuff he's done, like Red Mask and soon to be Murder Road.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, you two are both so smooth. You just let me down. I just feel
so
bad.
So smooth. Yeah, so thank you very much to the Comic House guys, as always. It's a great partnership. Let's all face it. Let's all face it, guys. It's great.
Oh, you've gone full Partridge already.
It didn't take long. I think it's because I'm so excited about this coming weekend. That's what it is.
He's on as well.
Yeah.
Same here. Yeah, it'll be good.
Do you think, like, if we have like a bag of Haribo, we'll just absolutely lose our minds because of the numbers that will go through our systems?
I'm already like running around and just, you know, where's your table, Matt?
I haven't got a table this year, but I'm going as a punter. I didn't get a table this year.
I thought you were going to say you were going to go dressed as something. I'd love that. Yeah. Serious question: if you were going to cosplay as anything, you know,
Ridge Johnson.
The costume would be amazing and look exactly how you want it to look. What character would you choose to cosplay as?
Rich Johnson. We already talked about this already.
Not you.
I don't know. Because I don't get it.
I don't understand it. We have considered going.
I know what I do, but. I don't. I like cosplay when it's utterly, utterly, utterly shit.
Yeah. So,
like, if they made it out of fairy liquid bottles, cardboard, cereal boxes, and you can still tell who it is, you're like, now that's some skill. I like that.
Yeah.
So, I would try and go as the Ava unit from Neo Genesis Evangelion cereal packets.
Homemade.
Yeah. Just the paint that you used to get in primary school that. When you paint it, you can still see through.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
What's that film? Be Kind Rewind, when they make RoboCop.
Oh yeah.
Oh god.
Yeah, that's good.
I would want to go like that. Yeah.
Okay. So I once went to a party dressed as a pencil. This was in the '80s.
Here we go.
In this sort of stiff cardboard costume as a pencil with my face sticking out, and I failed to get off with any women at all because I couldn't do anything because I couldn't really move in it, and I made the mistake of just wearing my pants underneath.
It was
weird. Ready for it.
when you started that story, I thought it was leading to a punchline. I didn't realise that the story was the punchline. The whole thing about
I went as a pencil. No, it wasn't a joke. Genuine story. It's just probably one of the reasons I hate cosplayers so much.
Because you've had no luck yourself.
Yeah.
And there was a dude dressed as Spider-Man. Was it like a kind of a costume party uptown? And he kept his phone, his keys, and his wallet in the crotch of the Spider-Man costume, so it kind of like sagged down like he had a gigantic ball bag. And that just did not amuse me all night. Fantastic.
I went to a fancy dress party and said to the woman who was the girlfriend of the bloke whose 40th it was, I said, oh, did you not fancy dressing up then? I said, you know, since your boyfriend's party. And she went, I've come as a prostitute. I went, oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
How much love?
Send your letters of complaint to Awesome Comics.
That was just role playing. It's fine. They like that in the cosplay community.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Now, jokes aside, it's a bit of a special week this week.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's we're actually focusing on a classic creator this week. Certainly, Tony's been looking forward to this for a very long time.
Yeah. In fact, we had to get some messages in. I know Andy Clift and Sarah Harris both wrote in saying how pumped they are to hear it because, you know, they're really into the and want to know a bit more about them. really good.
So it should be an interesting week this week. And I know I'm going to learn a lot. I already have over the past week.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, this week...
You sent me a podcast about it, and it was just amazing, the guys who did it. Like, if you want to kind of get the full background history of Kirby.
They really go into it, don't they? And I think that's the first, the second or...
Is that the Comic Geek Speak?
Yeah.
Guys. Yeah, they do like two or three episodes, I think.
Yeah.
Like 3-hour long ones. Don't worry, this won't be 3 hours.
Yeah.
Well, it might be. they really go into it. And I really like the historical ones they do. Really good.
Yeah. Comic Geek Speak are fantastic and probably one of the longest running
60 fucking podcasts. They've done like so many, haven't they? You know?
They were the first comics podcast that I listened to. It's brilliant stuff. And those guys know a lot. So, definitely. Yeah. We'll put that in the show links as well, shouldn't we?
Show
some love. So this show this week is all about Jack Kirby. Now, to some, he may be a classic, someone they've always idolized his artwork. To others, they may appreciate what his legacy was, but didn't necessarily get it, his artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, it was just way before their time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, they've grown up in a time of, I don't know, Jim Lee's or Joe Madureira's and stuff. And
Jack, or even since then. Yeah.
Jack Kirby is quite a way before then. But I think, as we always say on this show, knowledge is power, isn't it? The more you know, and the more you see of Jack Kirby's work, and we know all our lovely listeners appreciate artwork as well. There's so much to love and to adore. Tony... Lovely Tony, take it away.
Just to introduce it, I think what you're saying is completely right there. And I think if you're saying Jim Lee, there's no bigger influence on Jim Lee than Jack Kirby. I think that is plain. You've only got to look at the start of New 52, when he immediately incorporated the Fourth World characters and, you know, all that sort of thing, parademons. And, you know, and I think that a lot of today's creators, Jim Lee's almost one of the older of today's creators, isn't he? You know, but you look a lot of today's creators, you know, you look at the likes of Mignola and Tom Scioli and, you know, Frank Miller and Keith Giffen and all these sort of people. There's a definite influence there from this guy. In the research for it, I was reading the Fourth World Omnibus. We'll get onto that in a minute, and it's got an introduction by Grant Morrison, who is, you know, the epitome of the cool comic creator. Let's face it, isn't he? You know, I don't think there's anyone who's sort of more out there than Grant Morrison.
Yeah,
and he is a huge. He comes at it. He opens his introduction by saying, "Look, I never met him." He said, "I wish I had." He said, "I saw him across a room at San Diego, and I wish I'd spoken to him because a year later he'd passed away." And he describes him. This is how Grant Morrison, who is a master wordsmith, describes him. He says he was a master magician, a Renaissance intellect, a beat philosopher, and a creative artist without peer. And I happen to agree with that. I think from an imagination point of view, there's no one greater than Jack Kirby. And I have to say, I'm never not dazzled by his work. There's never been a time where I've opened a Jack Kirby comic and thought, oh, that's by the numbers. Do you know what I mean? They never really have.
Yeah.
So I think what I thought we'd do is, we talked about this beforehand, we're going to do a little potted history. It won't get boring because we're going to talk about some of the creations that he's co-created or created on his own that are just so relevant now, especially like today. You know, people are reading comics based on the center character. You've only got to look at Captain America. You know, look at what he's doing now. And it's a character that Kirby created in 1941. But just to get into it, he was born Jacob Kurtzberg on August 28th, 1917, which, if you're listening to this as it's released, is about a week away. So he would have been 100 years old next week, if that makes sense to you guys. He was born in a very extremely poor... It's hard to get your head around how poor he was as a kid. Mm. On the Lower East Side of Manhattan, at 147 Essex Street, which I believe is just off the Bowery, down that way. And Matt, well, I know we're going this year, but every year we promise to go down there in a cab, don't we? And the booze takes over. But we've really got to do it this year. I think quite a few people will be going down there. You know,
I think we have to this year.
Yeah. And back then the streets, he was a Jewish kid, Jewish family, very poor. And back then the streets were, you know, like proper rough. And a lot of his experiences were based on that. His experiences, you know, growing up and surviving and fighting the other street kids and stuff like that. But he escaped by being a big fan of movies and being a big fan of what is essentially the two precursors to comic books, which were newspaper strips and pulp novels. And he was a huge fan of the black and white movies, and he'd creep into the cinema and his parents would be able to find him because he'd be, you know, you could go into the cinema and just watch the same movie over and over again or creep between screens and this sort of thing. And also a big fan of Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon, which I think, especially in his 70s work, we'll get back to in a minute. He actually enrolled in somewhere called the Pratt Institute, which is an illustration art college. Now, depending on which story you believe, and there are a lot of sort of, I don't know, stories that appear on the internet, you know when somebody gets a certain legendary status, certain stories exaggerate a bit, don't they?
Yeah, like us.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But if you look at certain stories claim that he only lasted a morning there, and it was due to, allegedly due to sort of some financial problems, he couldn't pay for it, or his family had offered to pay and no money had been forthcoming, etc. So he went from there and he found a job working on the Popeye cartoons, which you don't really see on TV these days, but as a kid you see him, didn't you? You know.
Yeah.
And there you'd be the ones where he opens the can of spinach and, you know, they were sort of fairly basic cartoons, weren't they? But he was described as, I think it's something like an in-between guy where he would do the illustrations between the main actions.
Yeah.
So if he was walking, he'd do the where the leg's sweeping between, you know, as it sweeps, he would do the middle bits. The punch would be where it's come from the elbow and stuff like that.
Absolutely,
you know.
Thankless task that.
Yeah. Mm. Oh yeah.
That is horrid.
Yeah. How have you?
Kind of like sweatshop conditions, like the work coat.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, and he eventually found more solid employment on political gag cartoons, which I think if you get is it in that? I know we've all Vince, we got the Kirby King of Comics book.
Yeah,
I think there's some examples of them in there, aren't there? The Mark Evanier book.
Oh, I've got
that book
as well. Yeah, I think he started off as a sort of political gag cartoonist, which are probably more respected now. Mm. You know, people who work for, you know, the big tabloids and the big broadsheets are going to be sort of well respected and collect their stories. But back then, it was a sort of fairly throwaway sort of thing. Mm. And then he started working on some newspaper strips, and we had the Black Buccaneer, Cyclone Burke, and my personal favourite, Socko the Sea Dog.
I knew that was going to be the one you liked. I could just tell.
Yeah. And then he got to work on probably the first creation that we would recognise as a comic character was the Blue Beetle newspaper strip for Victor Fox. And the Blue Beetle is slightly different from the one we've got these days. We've got a sort of anime influenced kind of character these days, haven't we? But back then, I think he was a street cop who changed into the Blue Beetle, I think, back then.
Okay. He also looks a bit like the Phantom. Very much so.
Yeah, they were heavily influenced by, I think there was a Blue Beetle radio show at the time.
Yeah.
And I think that they were influenced quite a lot for the storylines and that very sort of cops versus robbers and, you know, Trump, somebody trying to bomb New York and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's when he struck up a friendship, which lasted for many decades, with Joe Simon. And Joe Simon got invited to go and work for Timely Comics, which we all know eventually became, in some way or other, became Marvel Comics. And he eventually, when he got over there, he thought, I'm going to bring Jack over because Jack's a good egg. And he took him over there. And that's when the roses really began to come up for both of them. And they created, amongst others, The Vision. So these are the Golden Age version. So The Vision is not the one we recognise from the Avengers. He's actually a character that I think James Robinson brought back in the Avengers a few years ago. But the Golden Age Vision, Red Raven, who makes a brief appearance in an early Silver Age X-Men comic. And, of course, Captain America and the Young Allies. So Captain America was the big breakthrough for him. And they added the sidekick Bucky. And this was a real goldmine for Timely Comics. And as is the case with a lot of Kirby's history, he realised that they were making huge bank out of these comics, which were selling in their millions, you know, literally. And the creators and the people who worked on them were making nothing out of it. They were being, you know, he was finding it hard to support his family and stuff like that. So he moved over to DC Comics. Back then, there was a big trend in sidekicks. Before we talked about this before we came online, didn't we? But before Wortham and Seduction of the Innocent and the 50 Cent Plague and all that sort of thing, there were quite a lot of sidekicks. Do you know why they went on the decline after this? Any guesses?
It was the old Seduction of the Innocent book, wasn't
it? Yeah. Do you know what he quoted in that as the reason?
No.
It was because people seemed to think that there was a relationship going on between them.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ.
Pat Mills sends that up, doesn't he, in quite a lot of his work, especially Martial Law.
Yeah, and I think Steve Bissett signs it up in Brat Pack as well. I think there's a bit of that in there as well. But there was some amusing ones. The Golden Age Sandman had somebody called Sandy the Golden Boy. Mr. Scarlet had Pinky the Whiz Kid. Green Lantern had Pie Face. That's cool, isn't it? TNT had some, which is actually one of the members of this podcast nickname, Dan the Dynamite. Your sex name. Star Spangled Kid had Stripesy. The Vigilante had something which has definitely not been returned to, called Stuff the Chinatown Kid, which is, I've got to tell you, you're not going to see a reprint of that anytime soon. And we still see Green Hornet had Kato, didn't he? So we still see that.
Yeah.
So the pair went to DC, which was referred to at the time as going across the street. So they went across the street to DC, and they did the Newsboy Legion, the Boy Commandos, the Guardian, who was rumoured to be that character in Diggle, wasn't it, in Green Arrow for a while.
Oh, was he?
I think they said he was going to be the Guardian, but I'm not sure if he is or not. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
And a character that appears in Legends, which is Rip Hunter, isn't it?
Mm. Yep.
Yeah, so he's there. Then in 1943, Kirby went to war. So Kirby was one of those creators. He wasn't a GI who, like Stan did. Stan stayed in America, didn't he, and helped write publicity and stuff like that. He actually went. He was actually on the front lines, and he was an infantryman under General Patton, and he earned 2 battle stars. And he actually, I think he performed the role of a scout. I think he used to scout ahead, because they found out he was a cartoonist. They said, well, can you just scout ahead, hide over that wall, and just take a picture, do a drawing of what the battle lines look for the enemy?
Yeah.
Which I suppose is quite a dangerous job for someone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, God, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So he knew about it. And apparently he's quite open. He would talk about his experiences in the war. And I think he got really bad frostbite on his feet. And I think he's quite famously said something along the lines of, well, at least it wasn't my hands. And he got brought back to America and went back into comics. But he tried to initiate his relationship with Joe Simon. But I think because of Wortham, because of the problems that had happened around censorship and a lot of the comics, you know, for example, they weren't allowed crime in the title of a comic or horror or this sort of thing. They were finding it hard to earn money. And Kirby became, he did a comic strip called Sky Masters of, it's called Sky Masters. And he also started Challenges of the Unknown, and he did some Green Arrow for DC. Mm. So that's where he started. He also went to Archie and did The Fly. And then he returned to Timely in 1961, which obviously became Marvel very shortly after that. Now, does anyone know where his relationship with Stan first started?
I did know earlier this week, but I can't recall it now.
Well, Goodman, who was Stan's, I think he was his uncle, something like that, was the publisher of Timely. Yes. And Stan became the office boy for Joe Simon and Jack Kirby when they were doing Captain America. So in a strange sort of turnabout, Jack and Joe gave Stan his first job in comics, because he wrote a text piece. I think is in it something in like Captain America 8 or 9, something like that. He wrote a text essay. So it is down to Jack that he got a job, weirdly, you know, when you think of the problems that eventually came between the two, which I know we're not going to get into, but is an interesting sort of turnaround. So at the time, Marvel was struggling, Timely was struggling. They were doing monster books. And then they decided in 1961... they started the new age of comics as we probably know it now, with Fantastic Four issue 1. Jack did, what was it? It was over 100. Was it 102, Vince?
I believe it was about 102 issues of Fantastic Four.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that, he created such characters beyond the four of them. He created Doctor Doom, The Watcher, The Silver Surfer, The Black Panther, Galactus, the Inhumans, the Fantasticar, the Frightful Four, Dragon Man, the Negative Zone, Blastar. I mean, just look at those and think how much money has been made, how many products are still based on those characters. I suppose it's sort of put to pause here and just see what your first memories of Stan with Jack were. I mean, is that something, either those characters, or where did you first come into that?
I was I would certainly say I was always aware of like the earlier comics and stuff, but it wasn't until, I don't know, Marvel did like one of those sort of classic sort of reprints. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where they did the X-Men and they did Fantastic Four. I think it was like in the early 90s or something where they made a big deal out of like the first appearances of these things.
Okay.
That I sort of saw that artwork, and certainly I was so used to a certain style that it was really jarring to me at that age. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And I know,
yeah,
certainly for a lot of people, when they first see it, they don't necessarily get it. Some people love it immediately, of course, but you know, it took me a while to sort of get used to Jack Kirby's style. I didn't not like it. It wasn't anything like that. But, you know, it just wasn't for me at the
very
time.
Very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly, I mean, we'll get into it more as we talk about his art style and stuff later. But I think that was when I was introduced to these sort of characters. I mean, that aside, the covers, I always loved the covers.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you ask me, the Fantastic Four number one is one of the greatest comic book covers of all time. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hands down. Yeah. It's been homaged, it's been copied, you know. How many people have done that same sort of layout? I might do that myself.
That's got to suit you, isn't it? As
yeah,
well.
It's a true classic.
I can see the Red Mask doing that cover.
Definitely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And, a lot of his sort of characters, I mean, had that sort of thing that is quite appealing to someone like me who created the Red Mask. The more you find out about what all these different style of characters he created, that I think early 90s was probably when I sort of read a Jack Kirby book.
Well, I mean, I would say for you, Dan, I would say as well, Eric Larson. There's a very few who are so hugely influenced by Kirby as much as Eric Larson is.
Oh yeah, you can definitely see that in his work.
Yeah,
I think he's moved more towards showing that in his work as his career's moved on.
I think I might be right there in that. Yeah.
Because if you look at his Spider-Man run, you can't really see it there, but then he moves to Savage Dragon.
Yeah.
That's when
it throws caution to the wind, and like anatomy is less so, but it's more about impact and power, isn't it? And like, you know, effects on the page that Jack Kirby used to do. Yeah,
definitely. Speaking of which, Kirby Crackle, obviously, you know, is so good. There's a band named after it, and I buy my son the CDs. You know, so it's
nice.
Yeah.
The first time I came across Kirby stuff was in, I got bought the How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Oh, okay. Right.
And, like, it's got Kirby's panels in that and, like, breakdowns of, like, how, like, the compositions worked in the panel. And, I kind of like saw it from there, and I was like, this is very much different to the other stuff in this book. It wasn't a jarring difference, but like the other one was kind of quite run of the mill, great stuff, don't get me wrong, but like this is very different to the other stuff, and the kind of the dynamism in his artwork was always kind of like, wow. I think like Vince at the time, it was kind of a bit much for my sort of uneducated palate.
Yeah,
but then over the years, kind of like grown to appreciate it more and more.
Yeah,
I've got those Kirby layouts on my wall. When you start looking into it and learning, he's spot on. He's 7-panel one, 8-panel, and 9-panel one. Yeah, just
oh my god, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, to get
the 7-panel one, I don't know how. I was like, oh, you do it like that.
Not only that, but there's usually quite a bit of dialogue going over all of those panels.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're not interrupting, dude. That was interesting. Where did you first? What was sort of your first entry level into Kirby, Matt?
I think it was from uni. I think no, could be wrong. It was actually from college when I left school. Mark Laming was my tutor then,
right?
And I think I can't remember what he brought in. I think he brought in Fantastic Four, like trade paperback, you know, to trade to get. I didn't get it. I have to admit, I didn't get it straight away. It wasn't like, oh, this is terrible. I was like, well, I don't get it. Because, again, like Vince and probably like Dan, it's the 90s image sort of Tom McFarlane things doing in my head. And I wasn't really reading comics. And then I think I... It was a Mr. Miracle, not a cover.
Okay.
It's Mr. Miracle when he's it's a side profile view, and he's chained up to the train. No, he's chained I've got it in front of me here, actually. It's the rocket sled by NASA Proving Ground, it's got on it. And it's like the first page. I can't remember what issue it is. And then I was like, whoa. And then eventually started getting into it more and more and more. And realizing,
because I'm going to say, he's had quite a lot of styles over his, as he should do, because he worked in comics so long. But to me, I didn't really get him properly until, and bear in mind, I was reading him in black and white from the sort of Fantastic Four 1 and X-Men 1 onwards. I didn't really get him till maybe issue 30 or 40 of Fantastic Four. I think Joe Sinnott was inking him back then. And that's when you had the sort of coming of Galactus and the Silver Surfer and, the Inhumans and the Black Panther run and all that sort of thing.
By that time, the Thing had evolved his look, hasn't he? Because when the Thing's first there, he looks like he's made out of damp sugar puffs.
But he does, yeah. He looks like a sort of stroked turd.
But then it took a little while, didn't it, for kind of Fantastic Four to find its own. And
yeah.
I think that was from the off, like they... The looks, rather than have the looks ready to go before they went.
Yeah.
They weren't wearing costumes and the Thing wasn't done right, and then suddenly they found their feet.
And it was an extension of the monster books that Marvel had been doing just before then. You know, they'd made their money out of repackaging, the names of monster over and over again, which incidentally is where Groot came from.
Yeah.
You know, Groot was originally a pre-Fantastic Four monster book. And then they nicked the name back again. But it started as a sort of almost like a monster, then you had the Mole Man and that stuff thing. And, I mean, Kirby wasn't raw then because he'd been drawing for decades, but I don't...
He was
44
when he did the first issue of the Fantastic Four.
You believe that? Yeah. Incredible, isn't it?
I think he's in his 20s, and is it John Romita Sr. in the documentary, like, with Mark... I can never pronounce his second
name.
Evanier. John Romita Sr. is like, as soon as he got to the Fantastic Four, boom, he hit his stride. And that was when he was 44. So you think about artists trying to make it today, and Jack Kirby at 44 is when he hits his stride.
Mm. Yeah. And you got to appreciate that he was, I think the way I hear it described is he started off by writing scripts, Dan, and then he found out that it was there was too much going on because he was writing four or five series a month. So he basically, Jack would come in the office and he would say, "Right, this is what we're going to do in this issue of Thor. I want him to meet Hercules," and they go into, then they meet Jane Foster, and I want them to have a fight. And he'd describe a story to him, and Jack would go away and write it or draw it. And then he'd come back and Stan would do the dialogue.
Because I think in that same documentary they mention that, and it's...
Yeah.
They mention it a little bit different, though, so I don't know which one's right, but they say Stan Lee writes down about four lines, like the beginning, middle, end.
Right, okay.
And then he comes up with it. So kind of like what you said, but a little bit different. Like, school four will fight, I don't know, anyone, meets Jane Foster, and then you come up with how he gets there and how it finishes.
Okay. So, there was a writing experience as well that he was doing, wasn't it, really? Mm. You know.
So essentially kind of like Stanley would lay out the bare bones of it and he would fill in the nine-tenths of it, really.
Yeah,
because Stanley, I'm sure he said it. He said, "I knew I could trust Jack, so that's all I had to do."
For instance, he said, "I think we watched the same documentary. Actually, we'll also put that in the show notes." He said that when it came to Jack Kirby, he never missed a deadline, and all of his work was exactly the same standard all the way through. Even if he had to do like 10 pages in 2 days to. Because someone else had messed up or something, Jack would come in, do it, and get it done on time, and he never lost a step.
I mean, the man's work schedule seems absolutely crazy.
Yeah,
I honestly don't know how he was putting out so much content like he was.
He was doing 15 pages a week plus covers is the story, and bear in mind the amount of books that were going out, I can believe that. You know, it's these stories get exaggerated, but I can believe that because he was drawing.
They're like four or five titles a month, isn't it? They're working on four or five titles. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, within that period, he was doing Fantastic Four, Ant-Man, Thor. He initially drew Spider-Man, didn't he, before it was handed over to Steve Ditko? He designed Iron Man for Don Heck. He was doing Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos. He he drew the cover to Daredevil and did have definitely have a hand in the design. Anecdotally, it's apparently into the Billy Club. The Avengers, the X-Men, the Hulk.
Yeah, he did the first arc in the Hulk, didn't he? He wasn't on the Hulk for too long, was he?
No, he wasn't. And then he went back to Ditko, didn't he, I think? Mm. Yeah.
So he kind of like seemed to kind of jumpstart a lot of projects, get them on the rails, and then he'd move on and kind of jumpstart something else.
I mean, what did he do, like 12 issues of the X-Men, something like that? But I think he kept his hand and did some covers as well. Mm. I think he did some more as it went along.
It's a testament just not to his talent, but to his work, right? How you should, if you want to be a comic artist or trying to achieve that, is have that work. It's not just all about talent, it's about working hard.
Yeah, Neil Adams says, I mean, Neil Adams isn't in the habit of being nice about very many people, but I think he says something along the lines, he said he would come in the office and we would watch him draw, and no one drew as quickly as him. Right. You know,
I don't know if it's a myth, he would start in the left-hand corner of a page and then work his way down. I don't know if I don't know if that is true, but that's what I've heard. I read about.
And he would draw like a hand in the top right corner, and then moved back down to the left and draw something else, and he'd keep doing different bits, and somehow it would all join up.
Yeah.
So essentially, he was putting out about 2 pages a day. That was drawn and inked by him.
No, not always inked.
Interesting thing actually in the Kirby book. There's a cover for number 7 of the Fantastic Four.
Right.
And it says here, though Kirby identified with the character of the Thing, friends have noticed the uncanny resemblance on this cover between Mr. Fantastic and Jack himself. So if you look on the cover of Fantastic Four number 7, it does look like Jack Kirby.
All the
more intriguing because this was the only Fantastic Four cover that Jack ever inked. Therefore, that's exactly how he intended the character to look.
That's really cool.
What issue was that, Vince?
Number 7.
Oh, I must look that up. Yeah.
October 1962.
Because if you fast forward, and we'll talk about this in a bit when he goes back to Marvel later on, he actually did an issue of What If. Have you seen What If issue 11? Which is What If the original Marvel bullpen became the Fantastic Four?
No, I
haven't. Have you seen this? It was written by Jack and drawn by Jack, and Joe Sinner inked him. And in it, Mr. Fantastic is played by Stan. The Human Torch is Sol Brodsky, who was a sort of production manager and artist at Marvel. The Thing was Kirby, so the Thing was still smoking a cigar. And Sue Storm was Flo Steinberg, who was at the time was sort of right-hand lady for Stan, and she later became a sort of quite a prominent publisher herself. And it's worth finding that because it's some of the best Fantastic Four art you'll see. It's really, really funny, and at points it has Stan like overstretching himself, and Jack punching people as the Thing, and it's really good. Yeah, it's really, really worth watching. You can find it quite cheaply, I think. You'll find it for less than a fiver.
One thing I did notice about Kirby was the boy gangs that were always kind of in comic, and I'd never really kind of got a handle on that when I was kind of going through the kind of Image stuff. That was kind of the thing I really kind of got into at the time, because it seemed utterly bizarre to me. And then when just doing a little bit of reading on Jack Kirby, you can understand where all this stuff's come from and why it was such a big influence in his life and his work.
Yeah, it was a real life experience, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, it was like Newsboy Legion and the Boy Commandos were basically about him and the other gangs of kids that he used to fight in the street.
Yeah.
And he would proper like put the smackdown on kids, you know. And there's a famous story about, because he's a hard guy. He was a little guy, but quite hard. There's a famous story about when he worked for Eisner. Eisner had the mafia used to apply like a towel service to the studio, and some guy from the mafia turned up and said, "Oh, your towels are going up," and Eisner's like, "Well, we can't afford it." You know, it's a sort of bullpen studio arrangement that they had going on, and he said, "We can't afford it." And Jack came in and said, "You know, get out, or I'm going to beat you up." Like Jack didn't care.
I've heard that. Yeah. I've heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a tough guy, you know, and also apparently like the nicest guy as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think when. Didn't always help him in business matters, because his career is a little bit of a hiccup after hiccup of business matters, but bit of a heart of gold on him.
I think Mark Evanor again, he said he would have been happy drawing a Fantastic Four for the rest of his career,
doing
stories after and that.
I mean, that makes sense to me if you think he did 102 issues of Fantastic Four, like just in one go, but he was doing the first initial arcs, you know, he wasn't doing such a long run and all these other characters. So for me, the FF was probably where a lot of his heart and soul was, especially seeing as he could explore those crazy out there ideas, which is what...
And that's when he started using sort of photos, collage stuff as well, when they go into the negative zone and stuff like that. He's actually adding sort of space scene photographs to the back.
Have you ever seen his watercolours?
Oh, a little bit, yeah. Yeah, in the
colour. If only he could have done a book like that with his watercolours.
Incredible stuff.
I mean, so pretty much a man that kind of strikes me is that one of the traits I can really identify with him, of being a creative and not really being too interested in the business side. But you can't ignore the business side. That is critical. Yeah. But just to be, the guy wants to create and he's really good at it.
Yeah. Well, he was a dreamer. I mean, there's stories of Roz, who's his wife, who also ended up inking him quite a bit, I think. And she's like this great character. You know, she would tell stories about because she didn't used to let him drive because his head was in the clouds and he'd be thinking up stories and mount the curb. And I think he crashes into a car or something at one point.
Rods wouldn't let him drive anymore. Yeah. As you said, after that incident, his head was, he was thinking of more ideas for his stories of whatever he was working at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose working for a company, although it was work for hire, that's the kind of ideal, isn't it? You don't have to worry about, what should I put on Twitter or how's this Kickstarter going or something like that. You know, he could just sit at his desk and he wasn't bothered by social media and he could just sit there and create. And if you look at some of the backgrounds in the early Fantastic Four, you know, where there's this sort of just fucking mental machine that's standing in front of it, doesn't actually, it looks like the most incredible thing you've ever seen in your life. And there's such detail that has gone into it. You know, just incredible
stuff.
That's
what was great when, they had, Mr. Fantastic had put out a bit of kit, and it's like this fucking great big machine that's just it's like an Escher drawing.
Yeah,
and you're I can believe that can open a dimensional portal. I've got no problem.
And, have you seen the animated ones they've done? Some people have, animated the machines in the background.
Yeah, I think I have, yeah.
Yeah, it is like a GIF. Yeah, it's great stuff. And it sort of shows the sort of wheels pumping and the Kirby crackle coming out of it and that sort of thing. Yeah, really amazing stuff. We've got the Black Panther movie coming out very soon.
Yeah.
You know, you've had Galactus, you've had Silver Surfer in a movie. The Inhumans, when's that start? Next week? Is it, I think?
I think so, yeah.
I think soon, so.
Yeah. If you look at what Marvel are doing now with their films, so you've got Thor, Black Panther.
How much of Kirby is that new Thor movie that's coming?
Oh, it's Kirby all the way. All of it. It's like kind of taken that long to get to that point.
I mean, just the look of Asgard itself in the movies is pure Kirby. Just completely.
Oh, it really is, and that's what I really made the hair on the back of my neck stand up watching that movie. Was when they're flying around Asgard, and you think, oh my god, it's like a Kirby panel come to life. It literally is, isn't it?
Ant-Man. That's
exactly. Yeah.
Always surprises me when I learn that Ant-Man was one of the earlier heroes, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was an Avenger, wasn't he? Yeah. Before Cap. Okay, so should we move along a bit on the history a bit?
Sure,
So in 1970, Kirby shocked the world. Just us comic readers, to be fair. And said he's going to move over to DC. After doing all that, I think there was a frustration again that he wasn't perhaps getting a bigger slice of the cake as he should have been. Stan, who was previous to that his office boy, and the guy who would go and fetch sandwiches at lunchtime and stuff like that, had risen to being the publisher of Marvel, and the big front face of Marvel, wasn't he? The circus leader of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So Jack moves over to DC. And it was billed as, the king is coming and all this sort of thing. It was a big deal for Carmine Infantino, who was also an equally great artist. I'm a big lover of Carmine stuff, but also he was the editor-in-chief at DC at the time. And I know the two of them were pals. And he said, if you come over here, you can write, draw, and edit your own books. Now, by some people, this is seen as sort of rather self-indulgent in the stories we're going to talk about in a minute. To me, perfection. Absolute perfection. And this is, I know on the run up, I gifted you to Dan and Vince a couple of issues, didn't I? And they both come from this era. So one was, should we start with you, Vince? So I sent you Commandy 1, didn't I?
You did indeed.
Which is probably the best selling, longest running story that was of this period of of Kirby's life when he went over. So did you want to talk a bit about that? Or
I think Commandy was certainly a title that I didn't know for until later, a lot later. But for those diehard Kirby fans, Commandy is always seen as one of the Kirby books, isn't it?
Yeah, and, definitely. Comes from Command D, believe it or not.
Oh, which really? Okay.
A button that you press in the Command D bunker. We'll get on to another brilliant name in a minute, but yeah, I think he had a little eye to that, little nods and stuff that, you know, would make you chuckle.
Yeah.
But just kind of added to the weirdness a bit of it all, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was certainly very interesting reading the first Commander issue. Now, first and foremost, it's the pencil work and everything is absolutely beautiful. The artwork sings. But, I mean, I think Jack's strength wasn't necessarily in a lot of his scripting. I think the plots and like where he's going and the creative ideas are all there, but sometimes the dialogue is a little. But when you've got artwork like this, it sort of sings above it. I mean, you got a splash page to start you off, and then there's a double page splash page afterwards, which is
a bit of a signature move of his, I think.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you've got the Statue of Liberty, like water up to its waist, and just the world is wreck. Isn't it? Because it's almost.
Yeah.
I mean, we were saying it just before the show started. It's almost like Planet of the Apes, isn't it? This was.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Was this after Planet of the Apes?
I'm not sure. It's certainly got to have a. It's got to be post the book at least, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like a mashup of Planet of the Apes and something like Kazar. It's that. It's got that kind of. That kind of style to it, but it's so kinetic. I mean. I read it digitally. The one thing I will say is I read it digitally on Comixology, and the modern flat colours do nothing for his artwork.
You'd rather have that sort of dot matrix colour thing.
I would rather have it black and white. To be fair, I'd rather read it on that sort of dirty paper. You know that sort of stock.
Yeah,
because it's almost too stark, and it really draws the life out. And certainly when I've looked at books and you see his pencil work or it's just his black and white inks, I'm like, my God, this is the most beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
And it just showcases how sometimes just a flat colour will just...
Yeah.
It will just suck the life out of it.
Yeah.
But there's just kinetic energy. There's nothing...
And backgrounds. You know, this geezer never fucking... underdoes a background, does he?
Never. You know, never.
He's got a five panel page here and it's got 15 horses in one of the panels.
There's so much going on in this, and like different, there's like a race of tiger beings, isn't there, and they're fighting. There's a wonderful map in the back that's what I liked about it as well. You had this sort of crazy story that I was like, the hell have I just read? Do you know what I mean? My nose is bleeding and I was thinking, Jesus, what is this? But then you've got this wonderful map that shows you the world of Commandy. At first you're looking at it and you think, oh, it looks like an alien world. And then it sort of zoomed out and was like, hang on, that's just North America.
Yeah. I love that it's got Dominion of the Devils. That's Canada. Wild Human Preserve is Mexico. And then Intelligent Killer Whale Raiders is the Atlantic. It's just...
I tell you what, I love the Intelligent Killer Whale Raiders, who apparently get a storyline later. And also, that's a band name. That's got band name written all over it, hasn't
it? If I find that issue at London, I'm buying you that issue. Because that is fucking genius.
Amazing, amazing. And it does have a proper sort of old school sort of cliffhanger that I was like, what? As if it wasn't crazy enough.
Yeah.
Do you not like the Island of Kangarat Murder Society?
Oh dear. And plus there's also just one section that is just human herds found in all forested areas.
Yeah. And that's New York, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is a map that just sort of says Commandy's continent. This map covers the extent of Commandy's initial adventures into a world struck by a great cataclysm. It's not the world we know, but an exciting world to explore. There's a massive bit that just says Dominion of the Devils, which takes up a good part of it. Looking at that map, though, now, I completely see Kirby's influence on a lot of stuff that I used to read when I was a kid, like the A4 sort of like UK comics that used to hit the stands. Because you have this sort of map in the background with information, and you have this commandy character in the foreground, and that's very reminiscent to me of some of the sort of back matter you get in sort of Eagle or Battle, or like, you know, where you have the hero character and there's some sort of information, or like, you know, just a quiz or something going on in the background. Thank you for gifting this to me, Tony. It was fascinating to read.
Well, I gave you both first issues because I hoped that you would continue with them, and I think you probably will with them. They're both...
I mean, certainly if you want them digitally, folks, you can get Commandy for like 69p an issue.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly... I think I might be going for the dirty paper option, purely because I think...
I don't think because it's Kirby, they're expensive. These are in the dollar bins at New York, aren't they, Matt? When we go there, you can find these issues.
Yeah.
Really?
I got the one we'll talk about in a minute. I got the first issue of that for $3. Yeah, just incredible. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all. Like when I go to New York and go through the boxes and bins, I'm just buying Kirby pretty much there.
Yeah.
Because it's so cheap. I'm finding stuff there now I've never seen in anything over here.
I think he has, because of his name, you kind of think that all his stuff is gold dust and must make, you know, so much money. But he did say, if you think about it, he's done so much output.
Well, to go off track, like, I think either Tony and Mark, or one and either, have bought me, he did a strip for Image with a trading card on the front.
Oh, is it Bombast or something like that? Or
something like
Silver
that,
Star? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's got like a silver, it's like a foil card on it, isn't it?
Yeah, which I've still kept it all together. But,
obviously.
Yeah, so he's done stuff that Jack Kirby's done work that you might not be able, you think, I can't afford that. Just people are out there listening, just look and you'll find his stuff for really cheap, like on old paper, obviously, but
definitely.
Like, and it's 100% worth it, get it. You know,
well, me and you stand there. There's one particular store in New York, isn't there, that sells sort of lower grade copies of like silver and golden age books.
Yeah.
And we stand there going, what about this? Oh, look at that. What about this? Look at that. You know,
yeah.
It's incredible stuff. Yeah. Just to quickly go back to Commandy. So just give a little summary of it. So it ran from 72 to 78. A chemical gets dumped in the water and animals become sentient. So you've got dogs, coyotes, crocodiles, tigers, sloths, wolves.
Don't forget the kangaroos.
And there's also some sort of robots thrown into the mix, and fake humans, and people who can turn into metal, and you know, there's Dr. Camus, who is a dog scientist.
Now he's interesting. This just shows my mental age, because whenever I saw it, I just saw the word anus with a C at the start.
Yeah, in Dr. Canus. Yeah. There's a great Caesar, who's a leader of the Tiger Empire, and then you get a detective with the best name ever, Mylock Bloodstalker.
Amazing.
He fucking got some good names, isn't he?
Yeah. I love the Tiger Empire as well. They're awesome.
Yeah, it's still readable. This stuff, you know, it's just really readable. You know, I'm going to say this about five times in this episode, but if I was at a comic convention and I walked past and there was a young geezer there, or an old geezer, whoever, selling these books, and I'd never seen them before, and they weren't Marvel, they were just self-published, people would be going fucking mental for them.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they? You know, if somebody here came up with Commandy and they were sat at a table at True Believers or London Super Comic Con or wherever, people would be going nuts for them. Yeah. Such imagination. Yeah. Cool. Okay, so part of that new wave of when he went to DC in the 70s was also Mr. Miracle, which is one I bought for you, Dan. Did you want to talk a little bit about that one?
That's a cracking read. It's really fun and enjoyable. This story, like you say, is kind of a bit crazy. Like Mr. Miracle, the original, was kind of like caught in a field and these mafioso are about to like fuck him over. And then this dude like just appears out of nowhere and busts him up and becomes the new Mr. Miracle. I didn't really see this coming. But it's a really kind of like callback to kind of classic kind of comics, which this is.
Yeah,
and again, like the kind of there's some of the wacky, crazy stuff. Like there's a bit where they set a trap up and like this huge iron ball rolling towards the original Mr. Miracle. It's so well done. Like you said, the kind of the energy just absolutely jumps off the page.
It really does, doesn't it? Yeah. No one does. I'll tell you what he does as well. He does great sort of gunfire. Yeah. Whenever anyone fires a gun, it looks like there's a fucking missile launching out the end of the barrel of the gun.
Yeah.
You know, none of this sort of just pow pow. It's sort of like, it's fucking hell. It looks like a laser.
But there's some stuff,
whether it be gangsters or aliens, you know?
Yeah.
There's one scene where, like, what's his name? Scott, he blasts off, like, chains off his body, and they all kind of shoot out. And it's so well done. Like, they're coming to the broken buckles in the chain, right up, right, like, the links of it, right up against the panel.
Right.
And yeah, it really get that illustrate, like, the depth going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good.
Mr. Miracle, as well, was always a character, even when I was a kid, I loved the look of. I didn't know anything about him. I did not know anything about him. I still don't really know much about him, apart from, like, him showing up in some of the great, sort of, like, Justice League Internationals and stuff, the Bwahaha sort of issues.
Well, I always looked at it and thought, is that his skin, that mask?
Yeah.
But he was actually called Scott Free. So that's another brilliant name.
Yeah, that's the one I remember now.
Have you read the new series?
I haven't, no. I own it, but I haven't got to it yet.
I will say it is fantastic.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I'm really good. Really cinematic, and it's clear that Tom King knows his stuff, and I think he's very respectful to this sort of era of Kirby and stuff.
Is it Mitch Gerrard's doing it with him?
He is indeed,
Yeah, they've become quite a duo now, haven't they?
Yeah.
I think I'd have a hard time writing this comic, has to be said.
Yeah.
You know, some projects, you're kind of not denigrating in any way. Mm. It's like, I would struggle write this.
I tell you what, the new Mr. Miracle, Dan, I would definitely recommend it to you. It's very, because I read it thinking, right, let's see what this is all about. You know, it was a good jumping on point, and it really is. Especially
I'll
now
see if I can pick up a copy on next weekend.
Yeah, you probably will be able to. Yeah, I think they're going to reprint it, aren't they, as well, the first issue?
Yeah.
Because it's sold out. Yeah. He was. Did you know who he was based on? Anyone? Or
he was based on one of his colleagues. It was. I can't remember the bloody guy's name now.
You know this, Matt, don't you?
What's that?
Mr. Miracle was based on?
No, I don't actually.
It was based on Jim Steranko.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Jim Steranko was an escapologist before he was a commentator. One of his many jobs.
That's a strange leap.
Yeah, the only thing Jim gets out of now is his syrup. But he used to, that was one of his things, lock me up in these chains, I'll get out of them. And to be fair, that was kind of a little bit of a staple of the Mr. Miracle story, where, you know, he would be captured by a villain and they think, oh, I know what we'll do. Rather than just shoot him in the head, we'll tie him up and put him in water or something.
Yeah.
And he drowns, you know. Well, of course he's going to escape. He's an escapologist based on Jim Steranko. Jim Steranko would be defeated.
In the end, in Miracle Man, the first issue, he attached him to a rocket. And it's like, well, he's a mafia boss. If you got this much money to be shooting a rocket up into the air, why are you worrying about a few quid a skipologist owes you? I don't want to... But still, great read,
I love though. That you brought realism into it.
I think that's the trouble of, like, always kind of... the kind of the things we've gone through now, kind of those kind of the fantastic things. I don't. Perhaps there's a sort of a thing we want to make it real, because that's what comics has been about relatively recently, hasn't it? Bringing it everything super real and hyper real and
That's why I love Kirby so much, because the stories are real stories, but the worlds and the people who they're about aren't. That aren't the fantastical worlds that you never thought you could think of.
Yeah.
Strength.
I'll tell you what I'd love to see you homage, Vince, is Mr. Miracle cover for issue 2. Have you seen that one where he's tied up and he's getting knives are sort of flying towards him and you get sort of a side view of it? Oh, I'm not sure if it's reprinted in that book or not, but I think you'd really like it. I think it'd really suit you.
Oh, my word. Yes, I'm just looking at it now. It's also worth it just because it says, also meet Granny Goodness.
Ah, now we're going to get on to Granny Goodness in a minute. Yeah.
she reaches out of this world to make deadly little things like the X-Pit.
Granny Goodness is not part of the Gilf area on X-Hamster, by the way.
Yeah. So one thing I really like about the Jack Kirby covers is the storytelling, and kind of a lot of the covers I do more recently are more pin-up stuff.
Right.
And I do like storytelling covers where,
me too.
You know, so in this issue, the Punisher dies, and then you go, fucking hell. And really, it doesn't.
Yeah, and there's like a speech bubble sort of thing. Yeah. I love those sort of retro sort of covers.
Yeah.
I think covers now tend to be, we talked about this in the cover show, didn't we? But they tend to be a pin-up with a title on them.
Yeah.
And I want something more. I want a story being told to me on a cover. You know, I think that's what the best ones do. And Kirby does that fucking on every single cover.
I think his covers for Mr. Miracle are some of his best, like quite easily. And Dan's spot on. Like, his cover for issue 6 is mind bending. And his cover for issue 9, which isn't well known, but if you can look that up, get a chance.
Okay. It's just
bonkersly good, yeah. You know,
So Mr. Miracle goes on to kind of sort of pop up in the New Gods, is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get onto, actually. Yeah, so whilst Commandy was almost like a standalone story, you know, pretty much, the New Gods, I think OMAC connects in with it, but Fourth World is what is a big, almost like genre of its own amongst Kirby now that has leaked into Marvel, into DC Comics and the DC movies, which we're talking about in a minute. But you had the New Gods, which is the core title, which had the High Father, Orion, Forager the Bug, which has recently been re-released, hasn't it? Metron, who's appeared constantly. The Black Racer, if anyone remembers the Black Racer, who's kind of Death, who's a black guy on skis, who comes after you if you're going to die.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's terrifying.
He's homaged in Invincible. There's a lot of Kirby characters in he's called the Black Racer.
Right, I get you.
Invincible.
Yeah. And then, so they're all on one planet, on Apocalypse, which is obviously the planet of Darkseid. You have the female Furies, who are Artemis, Bernadette, Big Breeder, Bloody Mary, Mad Harriet. I think I went out with Mad Harriet in the 80s. Speed Queen. You have Glorious Godfrey, Granny Goodness, the Hunger Dogs and the Parademons. Now, the Parademons appeared in Batman vs. Superman, didn't they, in that future sequence, sort of dream sequencing.
Yeah.
Calibac, Mantis, Top Kick, who trains the Parademons. So they're all the characters that are in this fourth world. And I think about 10 years ago now, DC brought out, again on this sort of paper that's a bit like a Vertigo trade, a hardback, they brought out the Fourth World series. And that has the Forever People, Mr. Miracle, and also, weirdly, Jimmy Olsen, because Jimmy Olsen is kind of where it started.
I've got a few issues of that, and it does connect. Yeah.
So that's where it all sort of started. And it's sort of this interlocking thing. And I know, who did we have on recently who talked about the artist edition when we did Desert Island?
Al
Ewing, yeah.
Ewing, yes.
Yeah, Al talked about the Hunger Dogs, which is where he was allowed to go back. Jack went back and finished the story. And then there was a death of the New Gods, wasn't there? I think series. Is it Jim Starlin did in connection with some stuff Grant Morrison did not so long ago? But when you think about Darkseid, he's a villain who's overused these days almost, isn't he? You know?
Yeah.
He's all over the place. So isn't he the character that's coming in the movies now? Is he the one that...
He will eventually.
He's referencing Batman vs. Superman with the future scene with Batman fighting the demons. His symbol is in
The crater.
Yeah, when Batman's looking out over the Gotham or Metropolis, wherever he's looking out, his symbol is etched in. Yeah,
and there's a rumour that I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, shame on me, but when she's walking across a floor, there's an overhead view, and you can see a mother box, which is a sort of technical, sort of mystical apparatus that the New Gods would use. And you can see the shape of it on the floor as she's walking across the floor, apparently. So, you know, this is stuff Jack was just given in 1970, 71. Say, right, you go off, do what you like. We love you. Come back and show us what you got. And he came back with these titles, which are fucking amazing.
Mm.
Yeah. Along by the side of that, he also had a few attempts. Nothing quite clicked. You know, I think Commandy was the longest run that clicked, and that was taken over by some other creators after he left. But he also did the Demon,
That's a character that I'd love to get my hands on.
Yeah, and that is a series that is fucking mental.
Yeah, that is bonkers. Yeah, and that's some of his best stuff, I think.
Yeah,
Demons.
And I think isn't that where Clarion the Witch Boy comes from, which is used in Seven Soldiers of Victory by Grant Morrison later on, I think. Sort of recurring sort of character. And he also did The Losers. I don't think he created The Losers, but he certainly worked on them. That obviously became a movie. So he did some black and white magazines, Spirit World and The Days of the Mob.
His romance stories are really good. You can get a special edition of that. That's worth picking up.
Oh, okay.
It shows, because obviously with the books that we mentioned, the very, as you said, there was loads of dialogue, but there's a lot of action going on at the same time. But in the romance books, you just see how brilliant he was as a storyteller, first and foremost, you know. So
definitely. And you don't need to clobber someone, you know, in a romance. Well, you can do if you like, I suppose. It depends on what you're into. But I'll tell you something I noticed about him as well. When anyone punches someone else, that's a fucking punch, isn't it?
Yeah.
A big old lean back and a swing through, you know.
It's Barry Windsor-Smith on that same documentary, and he's right as well. It's not violence, it's action in his books.
Right. I
remember that as well. He describes it. It's not violence, it's action. There's a difference.
Yeah. Okay.
And
this is the period where he started the whole, the 2 and 3 were splash pages often. So you would buy a comic, the first page would be this sort of crazy intro, almost like an overwritten page with summaries of what's gone before and, you know, sort of overly written. And then the next two pages were this huge, just like flabbergastingly good splash page, you know. There's one in Captain Victory where the Captain Victory says to someone, he says to him, "Oh, where's your spaceship?" And he says, "Oh, it's been over our heads all the time. I'll make it visible." And this thing turns up. It's like, fucking hell.
He does it with the first issue of New Gods as well, in a similar sort of way. So the first page is a little epilogue. The artwork on that is just, that's up on my wall now, actually, as we speak.
Oh, okay.
But he did that a lot, and he does it in Forever People as well.
Yeah.
First page you turn to is the one page splash, and then again, yeah.
Oh, so looking at that now. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
It's the two people sitting down back to back. Is that right? Is
that I've got that one. I've got a different one, but yeah, I've got the New Gods one, but yeah.
My bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's all weird. It's, you know, and he was doing Jimmy Olsen, which at the time people said, oh, he's going to do Jimmy Olsen because it's like bit of a sort of side book, no one's really interested. But you got to remember, Jimmy Olsen was probably selling millions of issues.
Yeah.
You know, people would buy that because it had Superman in it. Yeah. Allegedly, the story goes that DC didn't really like his Superman faces. So if you look at it, they were getting in, was it Ross Andrew or someone like that, I think? Kurt Swan or someone who would come in and just redraw Superman's face on every panel that had Superman in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you think he's really redrawing Jack Kirby, what's he doing?
That's mad.
Yeah. Yeah. So now that you mentioned Barry Windsor-Smith, I was just going to run through some people I think if you're in mainstream comics and you're not in some way influenced by Kirby, there's something wrong, I think. But I was going to just go through some people who I find personally have had a sort of quite a heavy influence from him, and you can really see it in their work. So we can discuss them as we go along if you want.
Sure.
So Barry Windsor-Smith, I mean, Barry Windsor-Smith started out, he was very like Kirby.
Yeah.
He was almost like a Kirby clone. You could look at it and think, oh, is that Kirby or not? You know. And probably the go-to guy now who did the OMAC and the New 52 is Keith Giffen.
Yes.
Yeah. You can definitely see some of his stuff. Mike Mignola, obviously. I think you can't doubt the influence there. No. Walt Simonson.
Especially
with his Thor stuff. And then one is a guy who we've had on the show who I just think is probably quite influenced, and it's Shaky Kane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, so you see that, and he's got that sort of blocky Kirby style, isn't he? Yeah.
Well, he didn't just influence people with the way they drew. He influenced people by making them better as well. Like,
right.
They said, like, they look at his work and see what he's producing. It all stems really from Fantastic Four, for, like the kick. It's like a kick. Like the Fantastic Four was coming out, and I can't remember who it is. And he goes, "I saw Jack. Jack do that, and I was like, whoa, I'm sleepwalking here. I need to up my game. And yeah. Everyone started to up their game. That's why we got such a good period in that time frame, because what Jack was coming up with in Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
And not necessarily draw like him. They just thought, wow, I've got to get better.
I think it's that old phrase of standing on the shoulders of giants, and a lot of where people are today and stars they perhaps take for granted is because of Jack's foundation of work and style.
But see, the previous episode that I was on about the Image period and that, if you go back and ask all those guys who may be your number one, well, they were doing things that Jack Kirby was doing, but not as good. So,
exactly. The
reason we like those, well, the reason I liked it, maybe Vince and Dan agree, is the dynamics. So we're doing a lot of double page spreads in those books. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back and look through those books, and they're quite a lot. I think if you ask Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane.
Oh, Rob Liefeld, obviously, is an obvious.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. 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 Well, seeing as we said earlier, Eric Larson, you know?
Yeah.
Who's your biggest influence? And as you said, Jim Lee, it's like, well, it's Jack Kirby. And if you go back and look through those books, you'll be like, ah, they're doing the same sort of double page splash, the epilogue and stuff like that, which.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jumping out of spaceships, punching people in the face, it's the same, isn't it?
And I think that the Kirby crackle is something, well, we call it that, is basically the term for the sort of like, what is it, like black dots energy, and energy sort of. Yeah, and like all that kind of stuff. I don't think that's ever been bettered.
I think
so many people have used it because it is literally the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, also used in generally in pop culture. Like the Kirby crack, where it's kind of transcended, moving beyond comics.
Yeah, you've got a little see that sign, and
that effect being used kind of generally. I mean, it's changed, but it is, that's its origin.
Yeah,
definitely. Here's a couple more. I throw a couple more names at you. So Steve Rude, I think, especially stuff like his Nexus and stuff like that. You can really see the influence there. And then the two who are the biggies for me, Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. Would we really have their style now if it wasn't the forerunner for them was Kirby, really? John Romita, both of them, you know, you look at their style and you think, so much Kirby going on there.
Yeah. You
know, both great artists in their own right, completely. Yeah. And everyone is influenced by people. I don't think anyone doubts that. But, you know, just there's so much going on, especially in John Romita's much more recent stuff. You look at that Captain America run he did where he went to, was it Dimension X or something?
Yeah, that's proper Kirby. Yeah.
Yeah.
That really was, yeah.
That looks like an issue of the Eternals.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
exactly what it looks like. Yeah,
I think one of the reasons I'm not too kind of hyped about that new TV series of the Inhumans is because like that whole Jack Kirby vibe and kind of that it's missing from that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think with that sort of thing, it's a royal family. There should be an epic scope. There should be something completely otherworldly.
It's got to be cosmic.
And it seems fairly low level, dare I say it, mundane, and they just sort of end up on Earth. That's what it seems.
Yeah,
there's nothing, nothing exciting.
I want them on the moon.
Yeah, I will say, Lockjaw looks fucking awesome. Looks fucking amazing.
Yeah, it does.
And that'll be the best thing about it, I think. I'll watch it, I mean,
but I can understand, like for budget reasons, they've cut this stuff down, but then why not choose the hundreds of characters you've got access to,
and
why go after the ones that the hardest ones to do
ones that they were going to make a movie for not so long ago. Vin Diesel was attached, wasn't he?
I think plans, I mean, I don't know anything, but I reckon plans probably changed and it got shifted a bit too quickly and it moved too quickly, I think.
Maybe it did, but
if it's good, actually, I'm gonna eat my hat, so.
I think Karnak looks good. Sorry, mate.
Yeah.
Is it actually connected to the Marvel Universe, or is it a standalone sort of?
Well, I'm hoping it's connected to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with their Inhuman thing going on, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it doesn't. Obviously, Netflix has got bundles of money and to throw at it and for all the Defenders and Daredevil, but it just doesn't look like it's on the same level as any of it.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Which is a shame, really.
It
reminds me of, like, when I went to a video shop to rent out Generation X on videotape.
It's
like you'll get one special effects scene. So, which is a shame.
When they get caught in the car door.
Pardon?
Oh
his fingers stretch, don't they, when they get caught in the car door at the start. I did actually watch that and think, oh, she's. I thought she'd be sexier. She looks a bit old. I think you both know what I'm talking about.
We kind of keep on. We say this like we was going through the trenches in the Baron years when you got stuff like that and the Justice League America TV film. And it's like, well, this is what we got. And then now we're sort of living in the golden age of the films, at least.
Yeah,
so I did quite. Like, I did like the Jubilee that was in that Generation X. I think she was the only thing that really kind of was there.
Yeah, I like. I quite like Banshee actually. The guy.
He was
all right. Yeah.
Should we watch it again and then do a show about
I've
that?
Not seen this. I've not seen this.
Have you not seen it, Dan?
Nah.
Oh, we're doing it. Right.
Yeah, definitely.
You can all stay around Tony's next week and watch
Gen X. Sleep and eat hot chocolate or something. Drink hot chocolate. I don't know.
Have a cup of tea.
In our sleeping bags.
Things normal people do.
Are you going to bust out the fondue set?
Yeah, with the hostess trolley. Yeah.
Penny.
Black Forest Gâteau, sir.
We've all got We've all got that friend who wears a penny and nothing else at barbecues.
No, we haven't.
And a hat. just wear a random hat with it. Naked Tony, penny, and a hat.
Yeah, I get one of those naked lady pinnies. That if it's be sexually confused.
And this is the point when everyone tuned out.
Right, I'm gonna go. I'll go through some more artists and see what you think. Dan McDade. I don't think there's any doubt. Dave Gibbons, I put in this list. I'm going to say I hope he's influenced because I can see some bit in him. I've never heard him. I don't know if I've heard him say it or not, actually. But I hope so. And another one that I see a bit of Kirby in, but I don't know whether he is actually influenced by him, but I certainly see it in him, is Mick McMahon from his Dread.
Yeah.
Tom Scioli, obviously. I know you're a fan, Matt, aren't you?
Yeah, Godlands. And Transformers versus G.I. Joe. That is, if you want a Kirby book for now, that has been released a couple of years ago, get that.
It's a homage to Kirby, isn't it, basically.
It's like Tom Scioli's gone, right, if Jack Kirby made Transformers versus G.I. Joe.
Yeah,
honestly, it is bonkersly good. Yeah.
Brilliant. Michael Ridd as well.
Yeah.
His Fantastic Fours he did. That's got to be in that ballpark. And then just a couple of others. Herb Trimpey, obviously. I know Herb famously redrew a couple of posters that Jack did, sort of publicity posters of the Hulk. Yeah. And he just basically redrew Jack. I think it's in that book, actually. I think I read that. Did you read that?
It is indeed, yeah. I didn't know how to feel about that.
Like, I know. I don't either, actually, because I liked Herb's work as well. But I think Jack would have probably just gone, well, I got paid. Or, you know, that's how it works. You know, sort of fairly sort of, who else should I say? And Mark Buckingham. I think if you look a lot of Mark Buckingham's work, some of the sort of illustrative stuff he did in Fables, I think there's a bit of Kirby in there as well.
I would it just came to me now looking at one of their pages. I think Ron Lim, probably.
He's on my list here. I thought, I won't read him out because I've read a load out. But yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah.
Especially his Surfer stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, all of that Galactic stuff, Infinity Gauntlet and stuff, that is just rife in there. And also, for me, I mean, once again, he's almost my go-to Silver Surfer artist because he was doing it when I was reading it. He did it for a long time as well, didn't he, I think?
He did. That was a long and a great series. Really good series.
Really good.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of my favourite Kirby issues, is because John Buscema drew the ongoing Silver Surfer series, but I've got a feeling it was like issue 18, which is the last in the series, was the Kirby issue where the Surfer, I think they just went back on this and decided not to do it, because I think the Surfer just goes nuts and says, right, you lot are in fucking trouble. and the final words of it are, I'll read it, let mankind beware, from this time forth the Surfer will be the deadliest one of them all. And I think they've just gone, oh, go on in. And they published that and they thought, oh, we can't really do that. Surfer's gone nuts. And then he was sort of trying to be everyone's friend in the Defenders. There you go.
Is that the splash page where he's just absolutely losing his shit?
Like mouth open, screaming, that one. Yeah. I think in that book it's real size, isn't it? How he drew it.
Yeah, it's like
you get a real size version of it.
Full size, and it's such an amazing page. for what is essentially like just a face taking up the whole of the page.
Amazing. So moving along a bit with the timeline, at the end of that period, I think Jack was a bit frustrated because they gave it a good go. So they tried, that OMAC came out and that didn't really last that long. The Demon came out and ran 18 issues and they were trying to, they said, oh, Jack, we don't really know what we're doing. There's nothing's really, really selling. Let's try a, anecdotally, this is what I've read, let's try and do a horror book. And he was a bit down at heart because that didn't sell very well either. But is also, fuck me, there's more effort put in a page in that than whole issues of people these days. I've got to tell you, I highly recommend that as a book you can buy for £1 a time. Incredible, incredible stuff. And he went back to Marvel. He went back and drew again another slew of books, you know, like non-stop books.
I will say, looking at it now, when he comes back to Captain America, I love his Captain America. At this time, it looks awesome.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as Mike Royer had started inking him around this time, I think, or during his DC period, because I know Jack had moved to California and he wanted someone to ink him who lived near him. So I think Mike took over and became very much sort of go-to guy for him. But Captain America, you've got to realise the period of Captain America that had just come about was the Nomad period, where Captain America, I think around the period of Watergate, and a little bit of an upheaval in American politics. Let's not say it's like now. Captain America decided, well, it's weird parallels we've got going on. At the moment, Captain America's become a villain. And back then, during a similar sort of American upheaval of politics, Captain America gave up being Captain America and became Nomad for quite a few issues. And shortly after that, not immediately, but shortly after that, Jack came back and did something called the Mad Bomb series, which is fucking nuts. Again, like secret empires, secret societies. Jack had become quite interested in stuff like conspiracy issues, chariots of the gods, the Freemasonry, you know, stuff like that. And that was very much in his books of this period. And you could see the sort of space gods and, you know, there's a secret society ruling the earth and all this sort of thing. And the Captain America, really, really great stuff. And he did the 200th issue, which fell almost at the same time as the bicentennial of American independence. And he also did a big treasury bicentennial book, which was inked with a number of people, but also inked by, who we just spoke about, Barry Windsor-Smith. So if you can pick that up, it is on Comixology and it's not expensive. It's a weird shape if you buy it because it's a treasury edition that's been transposed into a guided view. But it's some just amazing panels. And you can see, by that time, Barry Windsor-Smith was beginning to find his feet and not being so much of a Jack Kirby clone. And it was around the period, I think he'd done Avengers issue 100 and that sort of thing. And you can see the two styles joined together. It's really something to see. Beautiful stuff. You've got the sort of strength and the strong line of Kirby with a nice addition of detail by Barry Windsor-Smith. So he did that. He went back and did the Black Panther. You'd had a series between the two where Jack had done some covers, but this was back to just fucking mental. Just, you know, weird helicopters, strange midgets with, you know, monocles, and, you know, they were chasing this sort of, I think it was a golden frog or something across the earth, and yeah, it's just crazy stuff. He also did the one that I often recommend to people, which is a treasury, was he did the adaptation of 2001 A Space Odyssey at the time. Have any of you seen that?
Yes, I've got a few issues. Talking about obviously the comic, I've got a few issues of that.
Because they did the treasury and then it span off into its own series, and that I don't know what you think, Matt, but I think that's probably the wildest he was. It's hard to make sense of.
It's a bit of a he's obviously watched the film and then gone right,
now we're going to have cavemen and they're going to have machine guns and, you know, it's all this sort of thing. Pyramids.
Did he do Machine Man through that period? Or was that...
Yeah, that was where the origin of Machine Man came in, the 2001 series.
Which is bonkers as well.
Yeah. Totally bonkers. Absolutely crazy. And then it span out into its own series, Machine Man. And I think Ditko took over about issue 11... and it lasted about another 10 issues or something like that, I think. But it's a cracking series, well worth looking
at. What is Machine Man doing now? Because he was always a character that had a real visual look to him, I thought.
Yeah. Wasn't he in the later Marvel Zombies books, where there's like a squad travelling through dimensions killing zombies? Wasn't he in that? He was in Next Wave as well, wasn't he?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've only read one novel, Zombies. I think the first one, where they return into Galactus at one point.
Yeah, that's it.
They eat Galactus,
And then he's in Next Wave as well, the Warren Ellis book, which is really good. It's well worth looking at. I think he's still about. I'm trying to think where I've seen him recently. I have seen him recently.
Again, these books are really easy to pick up. Like, you can find these books at decent prices, you know?
Yeah.
Really can.
Yeah. When we go to Marts and stuff like that, me, Matt, and Mark, and Alex and stuff, we're always buying each other these books because you can pick them up for a couple of quid, can't you, Matt?
Yeah.
And he did what is kind of an unofficial continuation, I think I see it as, and is again the sort of Chariots of the Gods book called The Eternals, which is thematically in many ways continues on from the Fourth World books. And The Eternals Annual 1 is one of my favourites of his. I absolutely love it. It's one of my favourite books. And it's aliens landed on Earth, you know, prehistory type books, and bring it up to date. Yeah, really, really good stuff. And he did a Surfer story with Dan, which if you get, I think it's Jack Kirby Collector. I'm just trying to see the number. Can't remember the number now, but you get the full script from Stan in that. So him and Stan kind of said, let's bygones be bygones, and they did a Surfer story, which is really, really good. Well worth looking out. Yeah, so that was a little period of stuff that is just sort of crazy good. You know, but like again, like people were, they weren't appreciating Jack quite as much back then. His books weren't really selling enough, you know, which is a real shame.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So did any of you guys read any of that stuff? I know you've read some of the cap stuff that you've been. How did you come to buy that?
Oh, I think it was sort of later, really. You know, I just found like reprints or with a lot of Kirby stuff, whenever I find it reprinted, it's very jarring to me. I remember a Thor issue. I think it was Thor 500 or something. It was something crazy like that. You know, when Coy Powell was drawing it.
Right.
And was it Straczynski that was writing it at that time? And they had a Thor issue reprinted, one of the classic Kirby ones. And I remember looking at that just thinking, God, this reprint's awful. Do you know what I mean? And it harks back to Kirby's work being reprinted on, you know, just with flat colours on modern glossy paper. Just doesn't work for me. But I think a lot of that cap stuff, I didn't so much read it at the time, it was later, but I do remember, and I didn't know it at the time, looking at this book, I've suddenly realised that when I was a kid, I had a huge Captain America poster on my wall. When I was a kid, and it was a Jack Kirby cover of Captain America and the Falcon, which is in this book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What issue was that?
I think it's the issue that Kirby came back, where he's sort of like striding forward. Here it is. Number 193.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's got that real I remember I had a big poster of it, and when you're a kid, you don't necessarily see, you know, oh, that's Jack Kirby or something like that. But I remember just loving that pose and just...
What do you think of the kind of the argument of sort of people not having a go? But, like, they talk about the Kirby's choice of kind of dynamic storytelling over kind of rigid anatomy. And he's made those choices. I mean, I'm perfectly happy with...
Yeah, I'm happy with it.
It's hard to argue, really, but...
If I wanted something perfect, I'd read a photo story. Do you know what I mean? That's how I feel about it, you know?
Yeah. Some people can be very snobbish sometimes, come into it thinking, oh, well, the anatomy's not this, the anatomy's not that. When I read a comic, I kind of want to be taken away. I don't really want to stop to look at the sinews of someone's leg.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really moving towards that, loving that kind of really over-the-top action and energy, that's certainly like a byword for Kirby stuff.
Yeah, give me creativity every time over all that other shit.
He's done that on purpose to do that, like the dynamics of it. So he totally, if you probably asked him to draw it a little more realistically, like and stuff like that. But I think it's Neil Adams. So we're going back to Neil Adams again. He's not very nice about a lot of people, or pretty much everyone besides Jack Kirby. And he goes, you've got to look at Jack Kirby. Jack Kirby knows how to draw the anatomy. He's just figured it out, and then he's gone on to draw the way he draws, you know. Yeah. So like the little line is a knee, and you know stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if people do ever label at him, which God forbid if anyone does, it's like, well, hang on a minute, you get your, no. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
he transfers so he takes the mundane of like a bloke walking down the street and he adds like a huge amount of energy to it and passion and strength to it. You know, there's a brutality to all of his characters and intensity to all of them, isn't there? Even the sort of beautiful women just standing there, as they're, you know, there's a strength, and you know, you just see so much in that one image that you don't see in, you know, just someone who's just drawing someone standing in the street. You know, it's just more to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, I think he also should be given a bit of credit for being a bit of a futurist, because there's so many things that he sort of he was really interested in science and the stars and all this sort of thing. And he you know, FaceTime, everyone's FaceTiming. If you look at his issues, you know, everyone's talking on weird mobile phones or strange digital cameras, or, you know, there's all this sort of thing going on all the time.
Well, that was a lot of the angle, wasn't it, with the early Marvel stuff? There was kind of a lot more science-based.
Yeah.
Sort of, that's how we got our powers with Fantastic Four going into space, obviously. But, like, yeah, they seem, there was, they, that influence can be felt through that period.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a quote that I put on the Facebook page today. It's not in the draftsmanship, it's in the man, which is a phrase he used. I thought, that just says so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's incredible, really. You know, it's in the strength of it all.
Mm. Well, I'm looking through New Gods now, and there's a panel of, I think it's, I can't remember who it is because I've gone that far, but two guys, one's on the mother box in a car, but they're all dressed in normal, and it's beautiful, but there's loads of dynamism to it, you know?
Yeah.
The way he's done the hair, the eyes, like the guy in the background, the guy who's in the background is, there's a heavy blacks. And like some speed lines for the window, like he makes every panel dynamic.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I don't know how he does it, but like, he's just phenomenal way of doing it, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that is. I mean, it's incredible stuff. And there's, when you think about it, who else has got a magazine of their own? Do you know what I mean? A magazine that comes out a couple of times a year, all about them. You know, and it keeps coming.
Yeah.
After finishing that Marvel period, again, sales were a little bit down, I think, but I mean, not down compared to now. They were selling bundles if it was now, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He left Marvel, and he's always been a fan of animation due to his early career as well. And he went away and worked on a lot of animation projects. I think Herculoids, is that the name of it?
That sounds painful.
Hanna-Barbera stuff and this sort of thing. But he always seemed to keep his hand in, and there were some other books that came out post this period. You had Captain Victory with Pacific Comics, which I think went to about 8 or 9 issues. I know it's a book that you and I, Matt, always buy those issues we're missing when we see them.
I think it went to 13.
Oh, did it? Okay.
13 issues. And if you're going to get into it, I don't want to. It was kind of like his continuation of New Gods, because it's implied that Captain Victory was the son of Orion.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And then you got Topps Comics did the Silver Star Bombast, Satan Six. They did all that stuff, which was a little bit of a return to sort of Eternals and Fourth World series. And then he also did Destroyer Duck, which, as I understand it, was a bit Destroyer Duck. There's an episode in Destroyer Duck because it's a kind of a revenge comic for what happened to Howard the Duck.
Yes,
to an extent, the treatment of Steve Gerber. He got to finish his New Gods, which he was really pleased about. And he did a toy tie-in. I don't know if any of you saw it, called Superpowers for DC. Late 80s.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that line.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I think it was around the same time as Secret Wars. Secret Wars toys were coming out.
Yeah,
and they did there was, I think, 3 or 4 waves of figures, and I think one of them was a Mr. Miracle figure that came out, which is I think one of those toys that's quite expensive on eBay now if you try and buy it, one of those sort of ones. And then sadly, and long before he should have died, he died on the 6th of February 1994, which was, let's face it, probably pre-Twitter, and it was talked about at conventions, and I remember hearing about it and thinking, oh, yeah, I thought he was still doing comics. I thought he was still doing the stuff for Tops, and stuff like that. Really early, there was this ongoing, and I haven't researched it, and I don't really want to talk. And we've decided we're not going to talk about it, but there was an ongoing dispute around the artwork and whether he should get it and whether he did get it and what he got and what he didn't and what he was paid for and what he didn't. And Roz received a pension, a small one, but something that paid enough, paid the bills. And Roz, who was by his side throughout, and the anecdotal stories you hear as many about Roz as you do about Jack, and she survived him by a couple of years before passing away herself. I mean, Roz told a story. This story sums him up. She said she used to have to tell Jack off because she'd go out and she'd come home and Jack would be sitting in the studio chatting to some people who were just fans who'd come round, and he'd invite them in. And Roz would say, no, I was always having to make, you know, drinks and cake and sandwiches and stuff for fans because Jack sort of thought, oh, they're nice. I'll invite them in and I'll have a chat with them while I'm drawing, you know.
Yeah.
And she'd go in the studio. And he'd be sitting there drawing, chatting to people. She didn't know. I said, who are these people? You keep inviting in, Jack. But they'd sort of cunningly found out where he lived and sort of gone round and sort of bravely knocked on the door. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, because they never kept where they lived private or anything like that. They were very open people, weren't they?
And I think he was a humble guy. I think he was this sort of friendly guy. You know, he was quite humble. And I know you've got a couple of bits of audio, haven't you? You're sticking in, aren't you, Vince?
Yeah.
And there's the famous one, isn't there, where he's sitting there and he's doing a talk show and Stan phones in and it's this like real moment, you know, these two guys who've, you know, let's face it, whole companies are based on things that these guys have created.
Yeah.
And they had a chat.
Making money off it now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Hand over fist,
yeah. Yeah. We're supporting Disney now, aren't we, with that stuff, you know.
Mm. I mean, how many people can you truly say have a legacy? And he does.
How many people can create someone called Zaka the Toolmaster and get away with it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well,
that's Dan Butch. Ransack the Regent.
Pardon?
I said I'd got a cover of that love romance comic that he did. It's called Backdoor Love.
Richard Sennett.
A man ahead of his time.
Well,
so there you go. It's a bit of a love in, but I'm glad we did it because 100 years, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He birthed so, I mean, Defenders. I mean, he designed and he did the cover to the first Daredevil issue. And there is discussion to say that he designed the Billy Club thing. And all of us have sat there and watched Defenders this weekend.
Yeah.
He was responsible. He did, I think, a run of 10 Defenders covers. You know, so there's nothing in the sort of superhero universe in Marvel and DC that he hasn't really touched on.
Yeah. But where did people think he did his best work? We did a poll this week and we just asked you lovely people, in your opinion, where did Jack Kirby do his best work? There's just three choices. You had your Marvel, you had your DC, and you had your other. Can't say further than that, otherwise. Now, I think it's fairly obvious, but what do you guys think?
I found this really difficult.
In your opinion, never mind what the poll results are, in your opinion, if you were to say, if I put you on the spot now and you had to say one, where do you think he did his best work?
From my personal opinion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From the stuff that I've enjoyed the most?
Yeah.
Depending on what day it is, I'm going to say today DC, but probably because I just spent myself like diving into a sea of fourth world.
Yeah.
But then 2 weeks ago, I'd probably said Marvel. You know?
Yeah.
See, I'm the similar, so I would say DC now, but I would maybe in a week's time or the week before, I would have said maybe the other because of Captain Victory.
Yeah, I've got Marvel Masterworks, the Mighty Thor stuff out, ready to read it. Because it's got stuff that's going to touch on the movie, and I thought I'll have a read of some of that. Just remember the classic stuff, and that's just like some panels of it are burnt into my retina from when I was a kid reading it in Treasury editions. You know,
what about you, Dan?
It'd have to be Marvel. I'm a real Marvel head since I'm young.
I would say the same, and I don't know about you, but a lot of his DC stuff, and certainly a lot of, like you say, that New Gods and stuff, was a bit too far for me. That wasn't where my sort of mindset it was or is. It was a lot more of like the Marvel, a little bit more grounded sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's still crazy.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But our lovely listeners, 7% who voted said other.
Right.
21% said DC.
Okay.
72% said Marvel. And I think part of that...
I'm making it right.
And I think a lot of that is because the Marvel, all of those characters have become so big. They've become more, you know, a lot of the stuff he did at DC hasn't hit the zeitgeist that all of those Marvel creations have they?
Yeah, I think you're right.
We had a couple of comments. B.E. Muir, he said, his work at Marvel made me love comics. Enough said.
Yeah, and me. Yeah.
Hugo Boylan, he said, it's a really tough question. His Marvel work was superlative, but his DC work was where he seemed to push for what he loved.
Yeah, exactly right as well. I saw that comment the other day. Yeah, that's it. And that's he was allowed. I think for some good work and some indulgent, there's certainly indulgence in a lot of that fourth world stuff, you know, that he could have been reined in a bit more on.
Yeah.
With a good editor, maybe, and maybe it would still be running. But I love the fact that he was allowed to just go out and do it and go, fuck this, I'm just going to do this.
And he
went crazy.
There's he did a radio show twice, which you can find on YouTube, where people phoned in. And a lot of people phoned in about the New Gods.
Oh, okay.
It was about father-son relationships, about New Gods, obviously. And, yeah, he's very honest that he gets his ideas for stories and stuff like that by reading Greek and Norse myth and stuff like that, and then applying it to his own.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
nice.
Cool.
Now, Andy W. Clift, a good friend of the show, and someone who's clearly influenced by Kirby,
big fan,
in the best kind of way, he says, I'm going to echo what others have said. His Marvel work was groundbreaking. His DC work was boundary-pushing. Both will live forever. He's going for a Paul quote somewhere, isn't he? as is, and I think this is a fitting way to sign off this little chat, is John Late, Level 8 Comics.
Yep.
He said, only a handful of people are game changers. Kirby helped write the rules of the game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
That's a fairly drop the mic moment, isn't it? I think you can't say his influence is massive, even if you don't know it.
There's no way you're not going to improve your writing or your art by diving into something like Commandy or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it will help you write, and it is. Yeah. You know, there's some stuff you will think about and learn and develop yourself from reading these books. I think you need to know the history to be able to do it. You know,
and I will say this: even if you're not necessarily a fan of the sequential, the comics and stuff, if you pick up like a reprint and it's just not for you, I would say pick up like Kirby King of Comics, you know, like books that are about collections that have concept art that he did, that has sketches, have sketchbook stuff. You have these beautiful oversized pieces of artwork, because that for me is where my love for Kirby is just growing and growing. Like seeing the work, not necessarily seeing the printed stuff, it's seeing all the work that he did in it, you know, just some of the stuff that never went to print. I'm just like, my God, this is ridiculous how good it is. I know he, if anyone's seen the film Argo, that Ben Affleck film.
Yes,
of course.
I was about to mention that. Yeah.
Obviously, look up the real life story, but Jack Kirby was involved in that story. And he had to do concept art for a movie that didn't exist, essentially. Yeah. Google what that art looks like, because for someone that's just doing... he's essentially, it's almost padding to whatever this mission was. It's ridiculous.
It's amazing.
Beautiful stuff.
There's one that sticks out in mind with the three statues in the city. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Jim Lee owns that, doesn't he? Doesn't Jim Lee own it, I think?
Oh, God, does he?
Oh, really?
I've got a feeling he does, yeah. But somebody actually plays him in the movie, don't they?
Yeah.
Ever so briefly, someone plays Jack Kirby in that movie. Yeah,
yeah. I've forgotten his name now. He just passed away recently. He just passed
He was in Red State, wasn't he? He's a good actor.
Tusk.
Yeah,
things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Kirby, legend. You can't say.
Yeah, I tell you, and he was also in an episode of Incredible Hulk.
What Jack plays, Kirby was?
Yeah, he plays like the police. You know, when you have to identify someone to the police and they draw a picture of them.
Yeah,
he plays him. Sitting in the corner.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, brilliant stuff. We knew it was going to go long, so we haven't got recommendations this week.
Yeah.
We haven't. So deal with it, folks. But I'm sure you've been entertained and hopefully learned from Tony. Yeah. Well done with all your notes and everything this week.
Yeah, nice,
that was,
mate.
That was top good.
If there was ever a pleasure to research something, then this was it.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Well, we've been talking about this episode for a while. I know it's.
Yeah.
I know, because you know I'm obsessed with him.
Yeah.
And I know that Matt is. So Matt was like a no-brainer to get on as a guest. But I know that you two guys hadn't perhaps delved in quite as deep as some other people had, and as we had. And I thought, I was really looking forward to see. I was a little bit worried that you wouldn't like it, and you come on and go, it's old. Looks too old. I think I'm glad that you've really enjoyed like doing it.
Oh, it's been immense fun.
Looking at his artwork and then finding out more about the man and what he's done and where he's come from and what kind of fueled what he did, it adds so much more to it.
Yeah. And again, even if the geezer wasn't an artist, he'd still be like a war hero. Do you know what I mean? He's an incredible character. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
So amazing. Amazing man.
There you go, folks. It's been an amazing one. We won't really. Do we have any shout outs apart from we're going to be at London Super Comic Con?
Of course.
This weekend.
Table
number 8. Thank you, Dan.
Next, the Avery Hill Boys. Thanks for the shout out today, Avery. Ricky gave us a little shout out on Twitter. Yeah.
They have no idea what they're in for.
In preparation for us to really annoy them for the whole weekend.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be a sexy weekend. so we're going to be table 8 at the Isling. Where is it? The Business Design Centre.
In Angel.
Up the street in Islington. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Nearest tube, the Angel.
Yes.
And come over Angel Tube Station, turn right, walk for about 10 minutes, and it's on your left. You can't miss it. Oh,
it's where Kapow was. If anyone went to Kapow, it's where that was before.
Nice. Yeah. I cannot wait. We're hugely excited. Obviously, we're going to have some merch there. We're going to have some T-shirts. We're going to have some badges. We're going to have the print, which seems to be getting quite a few people excited this week.
Yeah.
But I only got a certain amount of prints done on the Cockney Kung Fu one, and I think I've already got pre-orders for all of them.
Yes.
I've got those pre-con, like, have I got enough stuff?
Yeah.
I don't want to blow out of anything. And I think, we made a decision earlier on, a week ago about how many prints we're going to get done of the ACP podcast one, and I'm not sure if we've done under the number.
I might have to see if I can get another 10 or 20.
Yeah, I'm seriously thinking about sale for the Cockney Kung Fu one.
There's a million copy shops around Angel.
Yeah.
It's not a problem.
So, we're going to have lots of stuff. Vanguard Volume 2 is launching there, isn't it, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for that to come through. I've had the proof. Through, found a couple of mistakes, so I amended them, and then just got back to the printer. So
we are at half mast waiting for that. So it's going to be quality, so you can pick that up as well. Because Dan Butcher's doing a couple of packs, aren't you? It's not just the book; you're getting shed loads for you.
Yeah, like last time I did a pack with the book one, where you get that sketchbook, a piece of original art, and a print of the cover. The same will be happening with two, but like the 2017 sketchbook, you get some badges in there, original art, and then get it signed by me if you so wish.
There you go, and the Cockney Kung Fu exclusive prints that are going to be launching.
Yeah,
are well worth it.
I really think I need to print some more. Yeah,
it's going to be well worth it.
Because we've got talking prints on the table. They're only a fiver. We've got one of mine. We've got mine and Nick's. Nick Prolix has fucking done a great job on the colour as well. Because I've not put the colour one out there. Wait till you see it. And you've got a Murder Road one, which you've done, Vince, haven't you?
I have indeed.
What size is your Murder Road one?
A4.
Yeah, mine's A4 as well. So that'll make a nice little pairing, won't it? Dan's yours an A4 as well, isn't it?
Mine, I've got A4.
Oh, what a combo. What a trio. Oh. Menage a trois. There we go. Yeah.
So we have. Pop by and buy them, because you not only will be putting money in our pockets, which we'll probably spend on beer later, you're also
we're trying to fund our comic, aren't we?
We're trying to fund our anthology, so we're hoping they're going to sell, so that at the end of it, we'll have enough money to send to print the first issue of the anthology. Yeah.
Everything that we sell will go back into stuff that we're going to do, but hopefully you'll get some cool gear out of it as well.
Yeah,
so. Yeah, definitely, and we've put some effort into them.
Yeah,
you know, it's nice stuff. We're not, you know, just going to the work photocopier and photocopying stuff. This is like proper card prints and stuff. Yeah.
So, and we will talk to anyone. So please, don't be afraid. Come up and talk to any one of us. Cups of tea are always appreciated.
Well, Matt, are you? I know you're just a punter, but will you have anything on you to sell? Will you have any prints? Because I love some of your prints, mate. You've got some sketchbooks, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got some sketchbooks and that coming up. I've got a few prints still left of Wonder Woman and Cyclops and Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, so, I own that. Beautiful stuff. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm working on a few things at the moment. I'm trying to actually do a webcomic, so I'm in the process
of
working for stuff for that. I'm trying to plug myself, but it's quite hard because... because of the nature of my job, it's just a bit mental trying to get down and being able to do, which is an excuse really, but to get stuff done. But I'm working on something called, I just come with it about 2 weeks ago, called G&T. So it's about a mech Delta Ops team with a big, you'll find it on my Instagram, my Twitter, a mecha and his detective lady with robot arm going out solving not mysteries, solving problems.
We've already sold me.
I'd like to draw some good women as well. I'll definitely go out with all the women drew if they were real.
As well.
So,
that's why he's drawing them.
It's really heavily influenced by like mecha shows from like the 70s and the 80s. So I just wanted to keep it really simple, no sort of like hidden meaning, just a simple sort of like Saturday morning cartoon sort of feel. There was that, and then obviously a big couch, which is still in the pipeline, but I just need to get, because the thing I feel about big couch is quite a big story, so I want to be able to become a better artist, so when I eventually do it for real, I think I'm hopefully be at the place to do that and print it properly.
Everyone out there, get some of Matt's work and tell him, sort yourself out, son, because you're a good artist as it is.
I've been telling him this for years, but I mean, the big couch, there is a fourth world influence on the big couch, isn't there?
It's majorly curvy influenced on the story itself and the design of characters and stuff like that.
And we might do something. We've had a little talk about something, haven't we, Matt?
Yeah,
a two-pager.
Just called it S.
Yes, that S. one. Yeah. Now, that came from the message boards, not message boards, from the Facebook page, didn't it? Where we were talking about a certain character and you said something about it and someone said, well, why don't you two do it?
That's what it works. So that's hopefully for the anthology, isn't it? I presume.
Well, we'll get that. Yeah, we'll get it out somehow.
And then I might have a project on the way for which I can't really go into much, but that would take precedent over G&T and Big Couch.
Ooh. And you're in Bark Hero as well, aren't you?
Volume 3, I believe I'm in. So I think that I'm not too sure if it's gone to print yet, but it's out there on the internet. You can find
that's incredible stuff. Yeah, I've seen it. It looks brilliant. I can't wait for that to come out and print, because they are. Have any of you guys read the Bark Hero stuff?
No, I've heard about it.
Yeah. No, I've seen the trailer on YouTube. That's fucking great.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of Simpsons and Akira, is that right?
Yeah.
Just replace Bart with Tetsuo. No, Kadawa, if I'm right. And Tetsuo is Milhouse, and, it is Al, and Akira is Ralph. So Kid Akira is Ralph, because if no one knows, the comic of Akira goes on for much longer than the motion picture film.
Yeah,
it's an epic. That is up there. That is the same as Kirby New Gods for me. That is absolutely. If you can get the, I think it's 6 volumes of that, get that as well. That's my recommendation of the week, actually, for get Akira.
Okay.
There's a bit where Ned Flanders gets absolutely like shot to ribbons. I was mortified when I first saw it.
Yeah, it is. And they've, if you go to the Black Cube website, they've got a diagram of who is who going down in a spider diagram and stuff like that. But that is really worth checking out because guys like Christian Ortiz, if I remember right, who does Golden Campaign.
Okay.
Ward Johnson Cadwell are in the first volume and stuff like that. So we've got really cool, great artists in that book.
Christian Ortiz, I've loved his work for ages. We've spoke to him. We met him at the that show, didn't we, at Orbital? Matt, do you remember?
Yes. I've met him a few times before, but
Yeah, that he's a cracking geezer. Yeah, really good stuff. Yeah, I must talk about his work more.
His work is bonkers. Yeah, good. Yeah.
So there's plenty of stuff of Matt's to come from the sounds of it.
Definitely.
And he was talking about hidden meanings just then. Did you find the hidden meaning that was in this show? There's several different ways that you can let us know if you found it or not. And you can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. That was pretty smooth.
Find it, Vince will give you a hug.
Yeah. If you can find that hidden meaning, we will give you physical interaction.
We'll give you a three-way hug.
There you go. You can also email us at tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com if you've got any events or press releases or anything about something that the small press community needs to know about. Follow us on Twitter at the Awesome Pod, where we'll be posting up. I think over London Super Comic Con, that might be a little bit more active. Who knows?
I think it might be, yeah. Hashtag sexy.
Hashtag let that sink in. Sorry, Dan. Sorry, Dan.
Mind blown.
Sorry, Dan.
I'm really excited about this convention because this is a convention in the UK that where I buy a lot of comics. You know, I mean, some press people, but there's a lot at previous shows. There's been a lot of
cheap bin diving, isn't there?
Yeah. So it should be good.
And we are going to have the bad comic competition as well.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Matt, would you use the pleasure of judging it? Can we ask?
Yeah.
Be the judge of our shit comic competition.
Let's be honest, if I was involved, I'd win.
he always says this, I always win that competition.
I always do. Yeah, no matter what. If there's anyone, you want to get anyone to find you the shittest comic at the convention, I will find it.
James Gibbs would be up for that. So,
So, Matt, what day are you there, Matt?
I think because I live so close, it's one train journey for me.
He's
so
going to Highbury Corner. There.
Yeah, so I think I can just. I've got a ticket for Friday and Saturday, but I think I might get one for the Sunday because I can meet guys after and after.
Yeah. We'll probably have a drink on Saturday, so that'd be good. Yeah.
I'm already drinking now, getting ready for it. So
sexy times. I tell you what else is sexy. Facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. I'm on fire. Plus, if you want to go to the only place where there's a great community interaction and like creator talk, it's the Facebook group Awesome Comics Talk, which is great.
Please join
because I just like reading it from now and then.
Yeah,
that makes me sound really sad.
We haven't had anyone fall out on there. It's been good actually.
No,
no one has fallen out. It's good.
It's been good. I'm part of that group as well. It's really good chat and.
Shall we all have a fight on there, between us, a thread, so that anyone who hasn't listened to this episode won't know what's going on?
We can call it the Your Mum thread.
Oh yeah, Your Mum thread. Oh,
brilliant. Don't make it your good mum jokes. Just make it your mum smells a poo or your mum smells a wee. make it the worst ones ever.
He's already taken my two best jokes. Anyway, thank you for listening to us this week. If it was on the website, awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podnose, or Podknife, or wherever you found us, if there's a review button, leave us a review. We need some more ones. We're desperate for attention. We do a podcast. Of course we're desperate for attention. So, be nice to us, please. Where can people find us online, etc.? Tony?
I'm going to remove myself from this equation and say two things. One, go to Late Nights, A Sense of Steel, which is the new Kickstarter by our pals, and A Love Connection that we made. We proved that, The Love Connection. Written by John Late, art by Matt Strott. Letters by Ken Reynolds. It's an all-ages adventure comic. Go to that and Kickstarter, and whatever you do on Kickstarter, give it money. Or go and see Sidesy at the Marcosia or at his table at London Super Comic Con and buy Impossible, which is the first issue in a space story, which is not doing it the sufficient credit. If you go to neveronanything.blogspot.co.uk, you can see some pages from it. I fucking love it. I think it's brilliant. I think Sidesy is growing as an artist. Growing as a writer and creating stuff that is well-honed, and he should be working for a big company.
He's great to draw for, so I did stuff for Dark Matter 2.
Of course you did.
As a writer and to work with, he's great to work with. He's very, very good, very simple, and great to work with.
Yeah, so go over and have a look at that. They're the two.
Nice. Dan Butcher.
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com.
Nicely done. You can find me at Jester Diablo online, and you can also find more about my comic at theredmousefrommars.com. Matt, where can they find you and more of your work?
Twitter at HP underscore Matt.
There you go.
Lovely.
Go
on.
I'll keep going. I'll keep playing. And my Instagram, which I post a lot of stuff up, is HPMap1984.
There you go. All right. Yeah, I follow that. It's great
the year
stuff.
I was born.
Of course it was. Thank you for listening, folks. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hopefully, see you this weekend. We shall see.
About it.
Yeah. Yeah. So stay tuned for more comic goodness from us in the coming weeks and months, etc. But until then, have a great week. Read loads of comics, buy loads of comics, just enjoy the comics world and the creations of Jack Kirby. What more can we say than that? So, as always, stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
I haven't got the trappings of a circus, but there in my mind is a very active and bright and colorful place that's as good as any circus that I've ever seen.